A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host for this journey into issues facing the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues these organizations are facing. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today we'll hear about a concert series that lies at the intersection between music and math. That's the theme of a new program this season at the National Museum of Mathematics, and I'll speak with the series curator, composer and scholar Bruce Adolph, and pianist Orly Shaham, who will be one of the featured performers, about finding harmony between the notes and the numbers. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Conducting giant Nicholas Harnoncourt has announced his retirement from the concert stage. In a move characterized by Deutsche Welle as an epical moment, the Austrian conductor made the announcement, citing his physical health, in an insert to the program of a concert at the Vienna Musikverein he was scheduled to conduct in advance of his 86th birthday. Harnoncourt was born in Berlin but grew up in Graz. He studied cello with the Vienna Academy of Music and played with the Vienna Symphony Orchestra before founding the Consensus Musicus Wien with his wife Alice. His conducting career has been noted for Viennese classicism, romantic works, and 20th century music. Conductor Yannick Nézet-Séguin has scored his first Grammy nominations, plural, for Deutsche Grammophon recordings with two orchestras. The recording of Mozart's Abduction from the Seraglio, in which he conducts the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, received a nomination for Best Opera Recording, and a recording of Rachmaninoff's Variations with soloist Daniil Trifonov and the Philadelphia Orchestra was nominated in the category for Best Classical Instrumental Solo. Other Best Orchestral contenders include Manfred Honeck and the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra for its Reference Recordings CD of Bruckner's Symphony No. 4, and Andras Nelsons with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, performing Shostakovich's Symphony No. 10, also on Deutsche Grammophon. Lincoln Center and the New York Philharmonic have chosen the architectural team that will transform the newly named David Geffen Hall, a $500 million project set to begin in 2019. The New York Times reported that Heatherwick Studio, led by British architecture and furniture designer Thomas Heatherwick, and Toronto-based Diamond Schmidt Architects will design the interior of the new hall, including the auditorium and common areas. Diamond Schmidt has previously worked on the New Marinsky Theater in St. Petersburg, Russia, and the Four Seasons Center for the Performing Arts in Toronto. Heatherwick, who the Times said is known for fantastical and futuristic creations, has also been chosen to design Barry Diller's Pier 55 Park along the Hudson River and a proposed river crossing on the Thames River in London. The New Jersey Performing Arts Center, Princeton Symphony Orchestra, Opera Philadelphia, and the Buffalo Philharmonic were announced as some of the recipients of more than $27 million in grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. Among those grants supported are NJPAC's performance project celebrating the life and legacy of NEA jazz master Sarah Vaughan, the Princeton Symphony's Portraits of Women program featuring a new work by composer Sarah Kirkland Snyder this season, Opera Philadelphia's East Coast premiere of Jennifer Higdon's Cold Mountain, and the Buffalo Philharmonic's Neighborhood Community Engagement Project, focusing on the international community of the city's west side. Other recipients include the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra, Princeton's MacArthur Theater, Philadelphia's Ballet X, Pennsylvania Ballet, the Knoxville Opera Company, the Nashville Ballet, and Bard College's Music Festival. Music educators are cheering the passage of the latest educational standards bill signed into law this week, saying the new regulations will allow schools to restore arts and music programs that were often pushed aside by those of the previous No Child Left Behind rules. Under new rules, there is greater clarity as to how arts and music should be included in school curricula. Chris Woodside is the Assistant Executive Director of the National Association for Music Education.
Music is enumerated. It's listed as a standalone subject for the first time in American history. And that listing connects to other listings of well-rounded education throughout the legislation, which provide funding resources, professional development support, protection against things like kids getting pulled out of music classes for remedial education and test prep.
You can hear more of my conversation with Woodside as an A Tempo Extra on our webcast page at wwfm.org. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. As I've explored in previous shows, museums and musicians are finding intriguing ways to create programs that draw direct connections between museum exhibits and the performing arts. Last spring, the American Museum of Natural History brought in a special dance performance about climate change to its Milstein Hall of Ocean Life. The new music ensemble Bang on the Can has partnered with the Jewish Museum in New York to perform concerts connected to various exhibits. And Bard College's The Orchestra Now program held its first concert in its Sight and Sound series at the Metropolitan Museum of Art earlier this month. Well, now there is a new series that brings together music and math. The National Museum of Mathematics, located in New York City, is launching its Harmonic Concerts and Conversation series this month. Composer and scholar Bruce Adolph is the host and curator of the series. The first concert takes place December 16th and features pianists Orly Shaham and Noah Elkies. I chatted recently with Adolph and Shaham about the series. Adolph, who hosts Performance Today's Piano Puzzler and is composer in residence at the Brain and Creativity Institute in Los Angeles, said each concert program draws on mathematical concepts that relate to music.
In 2012, the Math Museum, which is actually the National Museum of Mathematics, called MoMath in New York. It's the only museum of mathematics in the country at the moment, although there have been others. They called me to introduce a guest speaker. They have lots of guest speakers, and on a regular basis, they have a lecture series. And they had a young app developer who was talking about how he's developed fun musical games for apps on the phone. And they asked me to introduce him. They didn't know me, but I think they had heard my lectures on the internet, and they thought that I would be somebody who could say something about music and math. They just took a risk. And I decided to really prepare very well. So I looked up a lot of interesting facts and quotes about math and music, and then I got into it. And I made a rather substantial introduction. And at the end of it, they said, would you like to introduce other people here? And I felt like we were on the precipice of having a relationship. So we had some meetings, and I said, you know, what would really be nice is if we had a concert series here. And they said that they had been talking about that. They loved music. So we started planning it, and they suggested that it can't just be a concert series. It has to have math in it in some way. And eventually we came around with a kind of simple idea that there would always be a math element in every presentation, and perhaps a mathematician would be invited to speak along with the musicians, or they would provide from MoMath one of their mathematicians to be on stage with the musicians, so that in some way, whatever is performed musically, it's going to be related to mathematics in conversation. And that's how it started. And we have a series. It's the very, very first concert is Orly Shaham and Noam Elkies. And then we have Sam Sigmund-Povich, who is a violin maker, who's going to talk about the science and math of making violins. And he will be pretty self-sufficient with the math and the science. But we also have Kristen Lee, a wonderful violinist, who's going to play one of his instruments. And then we have Martin Bresnik coming with a piano trio, and some of his music has mathematical underpinnings. He teaches at Yale, and he's a very good lecturer, and he'll sort of carry that one by himself, although I will be at all of these. The fourth one, which is all the way in September, is based on my piece Einstein's Light, which is a film score initially, but it's a set of pieces for violin and piano that use music that Einstein loved and played on violin himself, and turns it into kind of physics math-inspired, very personal-sounding music, as if Einstein was thinking about physics while playing Mozart.
Orly, when you found out about this concert series, what did you think about the idea of participating?
First of all, anything that Bruce is involved in is always an intellectual stimulation and can be great fun to boot. But I did think twice about the mathematical side of this, because I remember vividly walking into my calculus class and going up to the teacher and saying, nope, I'm done. I can't understand it anymore. So I think I'm kind of excited to be part of this and to revisit that side of the brain in that particular way. I'm sure it's going to be an evening where not only the people in the audience, but also those of us on stage will be learning a great deal from everybody else there.
Now, how does the program for specifically that first concert kind of align with, Bruce, what you were trying to do?
Well, the first concert, we decided to have Noam Elkies, the people at MoMath and I, partly because he had been a student of mine at the Juilliard Pre-College, as was Orly, at different times quite a long time ago. And we know that Noam is a famous mathematician who has a very strong relationship to music as a pianist and as a composer. He's primarily known and internationally renowned as an extraordinary mathematician who found a counterexample to Euler's sum of powers conjecture. And I remember once running around the reservoir when I used to do that with a former student of mine. He said, "Did you see the front page? Noam Elkies is on the front page." And I said, "What for?" He said, "Well, you wouldn't understand it." I said, "Well, tell me." He said, "You wouldn't understand it." I said, "Just try me." And he said, "I can't tell you. I don't understand." But Noam is a hilarious guy. And he was an obvious first choice because he's one of the best-known mathematicians in the United States, if not the world, and he also is a serious musician. So then we decided together that we should have a pianist who can really pull together some just fabulous performances for us and really take the music as deeply as it can go. And I wanted to have Orly there as soon as possible. And Orly may not be a mathematician, but she's always been surrounded by people in physics and science, and she is very comfortable with that sort of thing. Even if it's just proximity, I think that means something. And I felt good having Orly there for lots of reasons. And at one point, it was Noam who pointed out that he and Orly were not at Juilliard at the same time. And yeah, I think he was right. I sort of wasn't sure about that, but I thought maybe they knew each other, but they did not.
But Noam's reputation is so big in the musical world that, of course, I've heard quite a lot about him. I think it's just, that connection, that those kinds of, those two different brains, the musical brain, the mathematical brain, a lot has been made of the connection between the two. And there are definitely many connections. And there were so many people when I was a student who had those very powerful abilities to see right into the mathematical world in the same way that they were able to see into the musical world. I think Noam kind of embodies the person who is able to see both sides of it at the same time. And
that's right.
Yeah, well, and I grew up in a house that was very much like that. So it's I'll feel right at home even if I don't have the mathematical lingo down.
And I really did want to have a balance. Noam tips us way over into the math world, and Orly is deeply in the performance music world. And myself, as a host, composer, and narrator type person, I felt like I have a little bit of yin and yang here, and it's going to be a really terrific show for people who are coming for musical reasons, people who are coming for mathematical reasons. We'll have everything, if not under control, we'll have everything available.
We are learning so much more now about this relationship between not just math and music, but science and music and the way these things work together. And you're at the Brain and Creativity Institute in Los Angeles now. How does that position give you a chance to really delve into some of these issues?
Of course, I live in New York. So I go out to the Brain and Creativity Institute in L.A. when I can. My relationship to them is that I'm officially the composer in residence, although I live here, but that kind of thing happens a lot these days with quick travel. And I also advise them on musical research. And they have a musical team there run by a woman named Asal Habibi. And they are all young neuroscientists who have been musicians, were performers, or have degrees in music, and it's an unusual team of people who do both things. And I've helped them with the research. For example, they needed musical tests in order to determine levels of understanding for various people that they were doing trials on, brain scans, et cetera. So I helped devise short musical tests where we could tell exactly what we were looking for and whether a person's answers meant something or not. I also have written music about neuroscience, quite a lot of it, including a piece that was recently premiered there called Musics of Memory, which is about different aspects of how memory works, but also it addresses Alzheimer's because the piece has a kind of a quality of degrading in terms of the quality of memory and how things come back and return as they morph into other things. And so we would do a presentation of music in their concert hall at the Brain and Creativity Institute, and then have a conversation with neuroscientists and the musicians in the ensemble and the audience about what they heard and how it makes them feel and what it makes them think about. The Brain and Creativity Institute actually studies the biology of creativity. It's not a touchy-feely place. It's a science place. But because creativity touches on the arts profoundly, and they love the arts there, I've been out there from the beginning, and they have quite a few artists coming and going in order to really have that kind of creativity be part of what they study and have the impact of people who actually are in the art form rather than only scientists.
This concert particularly attracted my attention because of, again, some of the crossover elements. As you said, you're bringing together two worlds And one thing that I've been seeing so many examples of in the classical music world is artists looking to find new places and new audiences to share the music with. Orly, from your perspective, what type of audience are you expecting, and how do you see this kind of reaching out and trying to gauge new audiences and new venues?
You know, it's a great question, and I have to say I've gotten emails from some unexpected people who happen to be members at MoMath and who received the notice about the performance and said, oh, you're involved in this? That's so interesting. Maybe I'll attend. And I think there is this idea that somehow, well, the academic world, they're in their own corner and they don't necessarily have time for the arts, although they might have loved them at one point in their lives. That sort of stereotypical image that we may have. But I think any place that you can go to in a different context and just make the point that music and the arts are actually a part of everything else that we do is a good thing to do. So in this particular case, we're going into the audience of people who are interested in going to the math museum, people who are interested in knowing more about math and how it impacts their world, probably people in many cases who are involved in teaching children, theirs or somebody else's, about how that aspect of the world impacts them. And we're adding into that the relationship to music and making the point that music is a part of all of these things. You know, I really feel that very strongly that music is another language that we all can communicate in. And anything we can do to remind people that that language is there and it's there for them is a good thing to do.
As you mentioned, you grew up being surrounded by science in your family. Do you have a sense that that contributed or in some way aided you in your musical pursuits?
You know, when I was younger, I don't think I saw the interactions, but I think speaking of sort of neuroscience, I think it formed my brain very much, because the kind of thinking that was going on at my house growing up was all very scientifically based. Both my parents were scientists, so they viewed the world the way scientists do, through the questions of truth and trying to figure out what cannot be true and what therefore must be true, what you can lead to. These were just sort of general concepts that were floating around in the house when I grew up. So I think that it's probably impacted everything that I do. And in particular, since I do so much of it, interpreting music, one of the pieces that I'll be playing at this event is a piece that Bruce Adolph actually wrote for me called My Inner Brahms. In it, on some level, he's sort of trying to access his inner Brahms. And it came as a result of a commission, actually, for me, because I was doing a project where I was immersing myself in the music of late Brahms, and I wanted other people to do the same and to kind of see where that took them. And I think even that kind of pursuit, trying to figure out how a composer impacts you, trying to figure out how their language, how their way of writing something affects your way of thinking about music, is already scientific in nature. I mean, the nice thing about what we do is I don't need to write a paper at the end and hope that when I send it into the magazine that the editors agree that it's worth publishing. I just need to make a work of art that speaks to people, and then it works sort of automatically.
That's definitely true. And one thing that is going to come up in this National Museum of Mathematics event, when Orly plays My Inner Brahms, which I wanted to say my inner Brahms, there are elements of how I put that piece together that I haven't thought about since I wrote it, but because we're going to be talking about math and Brahms and the connections of math and music, I suddenly saw quite a few things that are worth talking about in that regard, because, you know, Brahms had said he doesn't know if his music is beautiful, but it must be unassailable. And by unassailable, he meant that the logic of the constructions of his pieces has to be absolutely defensible, and he knows exactly what he's doing. And he was accused of, not only in his lifetime, but even afterward in the press, as being somebody who was dry and mathematical, which is kind of amazing for us to consider now, since we think of him as an incredibly romantic and deeply communicative composer, very poetic. But he was often called mathematical in a negative sense, which is also human, because it's a very positive thing for some people. So I was looking through my piece, and I found relationships between all of the cadences that is rather strict and very organized, and organized in a way that I don't think I would have done. I'm almost positive I wouldn't have done it at all if I hadn't been trying to do certain Brahmsian kinds of things. And it shows that, as just as Orly said, in thinking about Brahms, in a different way than I normally do. I was accessing a kind of level of research, some of it subliminal, but it came out in something which I can analyze now in my inner Brahms, which reminds me of the meticulous, careful, and rigorous, unassailable aspect of how he put the piece together so that nobody could attack it. You know, maybe it was slightly paranoid, perhaps, but it still worked very well.
There is something to the quality of Brahms's music that makes it feel inevitable. Whatever it is that's happened, it feels like it couldn't have happened any other way. And that is kind of like a beautiful mathematical equation where you're working your way through and suddenly the clarity of it, the simplicity of what's actually happening shines through. There's definitely an analogous situation there.
The very important thing is that even though it sounds inevitable, it also is new and fresh in some way or personal, because otherwise you could have just conventions that sound inevitable because they have a conventional, traditional quality. But there's always something you don't expect which then becomes inevitable, which is what most great music has, is this something strange and new about it at the same time as it has a logic that gives it that inevitability. And Brahms was one of the great masters of that combination.
It is fascinating when you read about, you know, for example, Bach and counterpoint and fugue, how mathematical it was. And yet, you know, I'm curious, from the composer's point of view, it seems as though it's just something that's so innate. There may be natural laws, but it's just so innate that it just comes out. I mean, is there any time at which you approach something very, very mathematically, very structurally in that way? Or,
well, I mean, it's important to realize, I think, for the people who are not composers or practicing musicians, that the relationship between numerical things, let's say design, architecture, structures, and sound is so complete that you can be thinking in sound, and you're also thinking in balance and number and et cetera. So there are things that work that seem right by ear, often sound right to you because of their proportions and relationships, which can be expressed mathematically. I actually very rarely think in terms of numbers and what you would call math when I'm composing. But there are times that I'm thinking about symmetry or parallel structures or some architectural device. And it may sort of skirt the border between sound and verbal thought, or between imagery, sometimes a structural image and sound. But it's different for different composers. And certainly even Schoenberg, whose music evolved into something that could then be organized in a sense mathematically and gave rise to what's called musical set theory, which is not the same as math set theory, but it's close. And it has combinatorial aspects that relate to math. Even for him, he wanted it clear, and he said over and over in various books that he didn't change how he composed, just the vocabulary and some of the available methods, that he still composed emotionally and felt right, that instead of thinking of scale patterns and the harmonies, which are a tonality, which are also easily expressed mathematically, although we don't think of them that way, that he was still composing really from the gut and from his emotions, but he was using a different set of paradigms. But I mean, even if you just look at a guitar and somebody playing bar chords on a guitar, those are parallel structures, there's symmetry, there are all kinds of things that one could describe mathematically, and you show it to the guitarist, they wouldn't know what you're talking about, but that's what they're doing.
And Orly, we spoke earlier about the idea of reaching out to new audiences. You've done that certainly through your Bibi Got Bach program. Examples like this here at the Museum of Mathematics, how do they represent new ways that musicians are looking to reach out to audiences, and how important is that to you as a musician?
I think it's really very important. I think what I always say about music is that it's about exposure. You know, I don't find that you can play music for people and then they say, oh, that did nothing for me. I think that music speaks to everyone, but not everyone is aware that it's there to speak to them. One of our big jobs as musicians is to take it to as many people as possible and let them know that this is something that could profoundly impact their world and their lives. With Bibi Got Bach, obviously, we reach an audience of slightly different mathematical abilities. I think most of them know how to count to 10. It is for preschoolers. And we do maybe a little bit of addition. I teach them how to count in music, you know, things like one is solo and two is duo and three is trio and so on. in this case, we're going to be talking, I think, primarily about adults who have an interest in something other than music, but that is also something in which you need some discipline, in which you need to spend some quiet time, you need some time for analysis. These are the same qualities that make for a great music listener, somebody who is willing to give it the time that it takes, to give it the attention that it takes, and then to reap the rewards, which are so many, in particularly in a live musical event when you actually have acoustic music happening right before your very ears.
Well, I think finding new audiences is, in a way, looking for segments within the population that have things in common because they like being together. That is a fun thing to do. And like the neuroscience crowd that comes to the Brain and Creativity Institute, having a math-oriented crowd come to the National Museum of Mathematics is also a really good idea because they'll relate to each other. They probably will have friends and they'll have a great group. We have a big reception after each concert. And I think that that's going to be very popular and probably help grow the series. And I know from my lectures over the years, I think it was maybe 15 years ago, it suddenly hit me that I could use other disciplines to talk about music and reach a very particular crowd. So, for example, I did an analysis of a piece by Mozart as if it were a murder trial. And I ended up finding it very popular among lawyers, and I did it for the Bar Association of New York and the Federal Bar Association. I've also done a comparison of a Beethoven piece to certain neurological disorders. Not so much Beethoven, but the music. It was somewhat humorous, but it was, again, a kind of a metaphor for looking at music instead of analysis, it was a diagnosis. And the feeling that there's a group of people who already share a lot in common, and they share an intellectual bond, and they share a professional bond, then they come to music together, and if you can focus that a little bit, you have a really distinctive audience, and one that is going to grow and come back, and it's successful, and it's also, because it's focused, it's really interesting. So it's a fun trend that I think is growing around the country and internationally too. I mean, I have been invited to participate in so many symposia and colloquia conferences on science and the arts and either math and the arts or music and brain science. They're springing up all over the place, partly because the science is catching up to be able to do this research. But it's a hot topic. And it's good that it's a hot topic because it basically means we're connecting things. And it's connecting things is what thinking is about, and connecting your feelings to your thoughts, and the arts to society. It's just a great thing. And I'm glad it's happening in such an extreme way right now. It's just wonderful to be part of it.
That was composer and scholar Bruce Adolph, who is the host for the Harmonic Concert Series at the National Museum of Mathematics, and Orly Shaham, one of the soloists at the series' first concert on December 16th. You can find more information on the series at momath.org. You can expect to hear a lot of great holiday programming on the Classical Network over the next several weeks. These specials are made possible only through the support of our listeners. To make a donation to the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for joining me for A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. An archive of recent shows can be found anytime at our webcast page at wwfm.org. Join me next week for another look at the changing world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is supported by the listener members of the Classical Network.